This is Ron Orl, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And we have a special treat here today as I have activist investing power couple, Jillian Colbert Alsheimer, and her husband, Sebastian Alsheimer. And just a little bit of background about the two of them. They're kind of quite interesting. Jillian left Goldman's activism team earlier this year and is starting up working as a partner at Perella Weinberg Partners, which is developing a devoted shareholder engagement, analytics, and activism banking team. And Sebastian has also made some interesting moves recently in that he left activist fund advisor Olshan from Woloski to co-lead the shareholder engagement and activism practice at Wilson Sonsini. So pretty exciting stuff. At Goldman, Jillian worked on some of the most high-profile activism campaigns. For example, she advised Humana in its 2022 settlement with Starboard, Kroger in its defense of an ESG contest launched by Carl Icahn, and she also advised Twitter, now X, on its 2020 settlement with Elliott in a deal that also included a $1 billion Silver Lake allocation. And she also advised Twitter in the sale to Elon Musk, which we wrote about 20 or 30 articles about. Sebastian, meanwhile, has worked with some of the biggest activist funds in the U.S. and globally. At Olshan, he frequently represented Elliott Management, including with settlements with Twitter, opposite his current firm, Pinterest, a dual class shares company, Suncor, and Cardinal Health. And also in his current role at Wilson Sonsini, he advises its tech heavy portfolio of public companies on how to defend against his former clients. So thank you both for taking the time.
Thanks for having us. Very excited to be here.
Long time listener. Great to be here.
All right. Awesome. So I have to ask right off the bat here, you are both the first couple I've ever had on the podcast. And I think it is fascinating that you both specialize in activism at the highest level. So until recently, perhaps till today, it looked like you worked on opposite sides of the activism ledger, with Jillian advising companies and Sebastian advising activists. So I have to ask, did you guys meet on an activist situation in which you were facing off against each other? And if not, have you worked on activist situations over the years where you were on opposite sides of a live campaign situation? I'm visualizing a hypothetical situation in which Jillian is working on her computer at the kitchen table and Sebastian is walking by trying to get a peek at his adversary's strategic plan. I'm just wondering if this scenario is a real possibility.
So we did not meet on the job, actually. We are sort of the last generation that met in real life, though, before app dating exploded. But in our case, that was at Columbia Law School in a seminar with Catherine Judge called, I believe, Architecture of Financial Regulation. So shout out to Professor Judge for teaching a class that was interesting, but evidently not so exciting that you couldn't flirt with your classmates. to answer your question, we sort of came to activism separately and independently. After Columbia, Jillian practiced in the corporate group of Wachtell for, I guess, 7 years or so before Goldman, which obviously included a lot of activism defense. I started at Paul Weiss, where I actually did work for Elliott back in the day as a very junior associate. Found my way to Vincent Elkins, where I became the divorced child of the Simon Garfunkel of shareholder activism, Kai Liekefett and Lauren Zellbaum. And that's how I made my way to Olshan and ultimately Wilson Sonsini.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
And to be clear, Ron, we certainly try not to be across from each other or really even on the same side. And I mean, it would be fun for us to be able to talk shop at dinner, but the reality is we have three small children, 6, 5, and 1.5, and we work super demanding jobs. So our dinner time table discussions are like, who is dropping our son off at the bus the next morning at 7:45 and who's picking up our daughter from ballet. It's just more logistics versus shop talk.
Okay. So you guys have never worked on opposite sides of a live situation, at least not yet.
Exactly.
Okay. I was thinking that it could make a great movie if you did, but anyways, whatever. Okay. So Jillian, tell me a little bit more about Perella Weinberg. So you left Goldman Sachs, you know, known as a powerhouse in activism. And I'm curious why you chose to join Perella Weinberg. Maybe tell us a little bit about Perella's aspirations in the activism space and how your background can be applied to help it.
Sure. So it was really easy to choose coming to Perella Weinberg because the move really was just trading one world-class institution for another. Mm-hmm. And it's an exciting opportunity what we're doing here at Perello Weinberg and my ability to lead this new practice. PWP has a rich history of developing deep client relationships, advisory relationships, and adding this focused activism defense capability is a natural evolution for the brand. And we expect it to be a competitive advantage for our clients and already seeing high client demand for the product. And in order to build this dedicated practice, PWP hired me, as well as a former colleague of mine from Goldman Sachs named Troy Broderick. And my background as a Wachtell Lipton M&A lawyer and classic activism defense banker at Goldman Sachs, combined with Troy's background as a capital markets banker, means that PWP is going to be a one-stop shop for well-rounded advice on topics like activism defense, shareholder engagement, corporate governance, and contested situations.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely looking forward to see you guys rise up in the ranks in the activism world. Definitely interesting to see the group of, say, about like 10 or so banks that work on activism, the whole situation shake up a little bit. So looking forward to see how that plays out. Okay, Sebastian, tell me a bit about your shift from advising activists all the time at Olshan to Wilson Sonsini, which I've always viewed as a firm with kind of a 50-50 split. I may be wrong. I don't have the behind-the-scenes details of all those private campaigns that they worked on, but that they provide legal advice to both activists and companies. Is that a fair description of practice, or do you mostly advise companies? Do you view the law firm change, your law firm change, as the major shift from advising activists to advising companies, or are you still mostly advising activists? Tell me about how that moving to Wilson Sonsini, what that's been like.
Yeah. So listen, the majority of our practice is advising Wilson Sonsini's public company clients on activism defense. So handling active engagements with activists, proxy fights, but also advising clients on how not to become activist targets, frankly.
Right. That's important. Yeah.
Yeah. That being said, I always like to say that shareholder activism is not binary. And there are a lot of great public companies out there, and we're lucky to be a regular counsel to hundreds and hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. But we also recognize that there are some really smart investors with good ideas for value creation. Mm-hmm. So as a legal advisor in this space, because of conflicts and client perceptions, by far the easiest approach is to pick sides and only advise issuers or only advise activists. But my partner and co-lead, Doug Schnell, and I determined that not picking sides actually makes us smarter as advisors and more plugged in with what's going on in the space. So although we predominantly act for issuers, we're a hybrid practice. And in our view, that makes us better at both offense and defense.
Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever I talk to the lawyers advising on the activist situations in Canada, they all tell me that they advise both sides. And they thought it's kind of unusual that in the US, it's either, you know, a law firm advises activists or a law firm advises companies. And sometimes a lawyer leaves one of the law firms that advises companies and shifts over to the other side. Inevitably, one side says, oh, you're going to the dark side. I guess I don't know which side is the dark side. But anyway, so I think that that's interesting that, you know, the way that Wilson Sonsini works like that. So,
but I should be clear that PWP does operate a little bit differently. As an investment bank, we only have corporate clients. We don't advise activists. So we do it a little bit differently.
No, that's important to note. And okay, so I wanted to talk about some kind of interesting activism situations. So Jillian, you worked advising Kroger's versus Carl Icahn's unusual ESG battle, which he ultimately canceled. I guess, anticipating that he wouldn't do very well and getting his director candidates elected. Nevertheless, that and Icahn's unsuccessful ESG contest at McDonald's really until recently were the only two S of the ESG acronym, you know, social contest I can think of. Until recently, a group of labor unions, the Strategic Organizing Center, have a director contest at Starbucks, and it represents what I believe is the first ever single issue director contest focused on labor issues. So Sebastian, I want to throw this to you. The Coalition of Labor Unions is seeking directors on grounds that Starbucks' current board's approach to labor issues jeopardizes the coffee chain's ability to fully fulfill its fiduciary duties to investors. And I want to also note that it's the first single issue, you know, labor-focused director contest in the era of universal proxy cards. So Sebastian, what do you think about this contest? You think that the universal proxy card factors into the decision? A lot of people say that it makes the cost of contests, or at least one aspect of it, less expensive. And I also noticed that the labor unions hired Okapi, a very prominent proxy solicitor. So it seems to me they're serious. So I don't know. What do you think about this whole thing?
Well, there's a lot baked in there. But let me first say that I will probably get in trouble at home if I attempt to review or critique Jill's advice or any particular situations that she's worked on. But let's take your question about universal proxy first. Listen, I've been pretty clear about not a total game changer in my view, but it is a material change that will make it easier to get one or maybe two dissident nominees elected to a board. We've only had one full season with the rules, a season that was a little wacky in some respects. I'm thinking macroeconomic backdrop and the collapse of SVB, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think the sort of settle mania of 2022 and early 23 will probably recede as advisors and people in the space get more comfortable with the dynamics of universal proxy. But the big difference that I expect to persist is that if a dissident can make a case for change, which is a hurdle that remains, then there will be enhanced focus on individual candidate quality qualifications going forward. And that's on both sides. And overall, listen, like, I think that's a good thing. But about the S and ESG generally, this topic has become hopelessly political, like most things in this country, unfortunately. It's already become a bit of a clown show, in my view, and there are plenty of people involved here who are not serious investors and are more interested in attention to themselves than creating shareholder value. And I hope that the courts will step in here and continue to weigh in here and clarify exactly what kind of non-economic considerations are fair game. And listen, like, different states are going to end up in different places here, and that's fine. But the thing that worries me with these single issue campaigns, and I fear this is probably the next logical step, is when these actors start recruiting celebrities as candidates. So think Billie Eilish gets nominated to the board of McDonald's as a candidate rights representative, or Leonardo DiCaprio at Chevron, Susan Sarandon at Wesson Smith. How about Bernie Sanders as a pro-labor nominee at Starbucks? Then I'm afraid that we've taken ESG deep into meme stock territory.
I didn't visualize that progression. But personally, I feel like one of the points that you made on this kind of resonated. I mean, all the points you said resonated with me. One thing kind of stuck out, which is, you know, you need to make a case for change. And I feel like single issues like a labor issue is just one aspect. And so, like, for example, the proxy advisors, ISS and Glass Lewis, I'm really curious to see how they'll view this contest, because it's not really focused on share price improvement. It's really focused on fixing their labor issues, which is just, you know, one piece of the puzzle.
That's right. And it's still true that if you can't make the case for change, if you can't get over that hurdle, no one's even going to look at your candidates.
Okay. Jillian, do you want to weigh in about ESG campaigns more broadly? Do you feel like we're going to see more of them and more ESG director contests? And by ESG, I mean, you know, environment and social.
No, I know exactly what you mean. It's actually a topic that I follow pretty closely. Certainly, the advent of the universal proxy card has theoretically made it easier for these actively engaged shareholders and special interest groups to all become activists with a capital A and nominate directors and push for change at the board level. You know, anecdotally, I am aware of multiple situations during last year's proxy season where these special interest groups got really, really close to utilizing UPC and nominating directors, ultimately not formally nominating. I don't know the reasons why. I don't represent activists, but they didn't nominate and they didn't run campaigns. But, you know, it's just a matter of time before we started to see these non-traditional activist groups pushing for this board level change using the UPC. So I certainly see a universe where the overall increase in support for certain ESG shareholder proposals during this past proxy season, as well as the situation you mentioned, combining that with the UPC makes it easier for these ESG-focused and shareholder-nominated directors to receive potentially a higher vote if they're actually put forth during this 2024 upcoming proxy season.
Yeah, no, definitely something I'll be looking closely at. There was, you know, this big expectation that we'd see a lot of them in 2023. We didn't. And so, you know, a lot of eyes are focused on this particular contest to see how it does. Suspect that the result may kind of impact how people view ESG contests. You know, I think we'll still be seeing lots of ESG shoulder proposals, but okay. So I want to shift gears a bit and want to talk about another one of my favorite subjects in the world of activism. And that is what I like to call the white squire defensive tactics. I know this is a loaded word and viewed very differently by both activists and companies. In brief, this is a strategy of a company bringing a large pipe investor, multiple large pipe investors, with the primary goal of helping to fend off an activist by gaining supportive votes ahead of a director contest. But it can also be used to help get a contested merger across the finishing line. I've seen it used there. I've also seen it to help defend against a hostile bid. I've seen it in a variety of different uses, to which sometimes successful, sometimes not successful, sometimes litigated. Companies, I feel, typically argue that these pipe investors are needed to provide critical financing when it is most needed. But activists argue the opposite, that these are entrenchment devices designed to keep incumbent boards intact to make sure a merger closes. So I don't know, maybe start with Jillian. Curious if you discuss the possibility of a white squire investment when an activist is agitating or a deal is under threat. Is it something that you suggest, you know, maybe you should go look for this? Or is it something that you feel it's maybe too aggressive to use? Or does it depend on the situation?
It's so, so, so rare to ever suggest it for a company to actually have some type of pipe investment, you know, white knight type defense tactic. It's one of the rarest tools in the toolbox. I have been on situations where we have done that. And every situation that I've been on where a company has considered even taking a pipe investment is so unique, super facts and circumstances specific. Mm-hmm. It can obviously be a very attractive defense tactic against an activist or against a deal that's under threat, but we have to advise so much caution against it. And there needs to be a clear business reason that can justify the investment and a clear discussion with the market, the shareholders, making sure that they will understand why the company needed to raise the money and what the proceeds were specifically being used for, and ensuring that the terms, given all those facts and circumstances, are fair and reasonable as it relates to the other shareholders.
Yeah, no, it definitely seems like it can only work in very narrow circumstances.
Definitely. I mean, can you quantify it for you, right? Like, let's say I've been on 100 situations. We have considered it and call it 3 out of 100 situations and done it in 1 out of 100 situations. So it is a very rare tactic vis-a-vis the quantity of situations that any person works on.
It's interesting. Sebastian, did you want to chime in on maybe looking at it from the point of view of the activist?
Sure. Listen, I think you called it a large minority-friendly investor.
Yes.
So, Ron, let's not call them friendly, because presumably these are rational investors putting capital to work and they're expecting a return, right? And second, let's also recognize that sometimes the additional financing is critically needed and it can be on fair terms. And while I think that pipe investors should have equal voting rights to other shareholders, I agree. I mean, voting commitments, especially in the context of an ongoing proxy contest, to me, that doesn't really pass the smell test.
Okay, so we don't have a lot of time. I want to get through at least a couple more topics. And I wanted to talk about governance, and often see companies with over-tenured, over-boarded directors who have close ties to the CEO. I wrote about a situation like that today, where an activist was targeting a company where there was a fair amount of directors who were there for a long time, let's say 15, 20 years, and the company replaced a few directors in anticipation or in hoping to discourage the activist from continuing to pursue its director contest, kind of a preemptive strike. Although obviously the real preemptive strike would be to hire both of you and make sure that board is overboarded or over-tenured, and maybe then they would discourage an activist from showing up in the first place. But I don't know, what do you guys see? Maybe Jillian, you could start, and then Sebastian, if you have some thoughts about, is this something that you kind of work with companies on? Do you find that a lot of companies are missing kind of the cybersecurity AI expertise that they should have? You know, do you tell companies that their directors, they need to move some directors out?
Yeah, I mean, governance is so important, right? Strong governance leads to strong and sound business decisions. And, you know, theoretically, poor governance leads to poor business decisions. So focusing on governance as a defensive topic is really important to doing good business. But as it relates to activism, what I tell corporate clients is that activists are value-oriented investors. And that means that even if there is a governance-related issue, overboarded, over-tenured, lack of very particular experience at the board level, unless there's always also some type of valuation gap that an activist identifies and identifies a way that they can fix it. So that's the key, really. The activist finds an issue that they specifically have the problem to fix, then a governance red flag in and of itself will not lead to activism, or at least should not lead to activism. But if there are governance red flags and there are business-related red flags, then an activist will happily use both of those vectors to attack a company, because the glaring governance issues used by activists, they're able to mobilize the passive index fund investors who hold the majority of the stock of most public companies. And those passive index fund investors strongly believe that good governance is the backbone to everything, including good business, good valuation, and it makes everyone money. Mm-hmm. And they let their voting decisions be guided by those governance issues.
The best defense against activism is generating great returns for shareholders, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to be that vulnerable if your stock is ripping.
Right.
Now, if that's not the case and your TSR is bad vis-a-vis the market or your peers, then naturally investors are going to start looking what is causing that underperformance. And one of the places that they will immediately look is governance. Because most people believe, as I do, and apparently Jillian, that there is a connection between good corporate governance and positive shareholder returns. But here's the deal. No pun intended. Whether or not the cause of the underperformance is actually governance, governance will almost inevitably feature in an activist campaign. Because to Jillian's point, activists have become quite adept at using governance as wedge issues, even in situations where the apparent problem might be operational, capital structure, what have you. So to your point, if your stock is underperforming and the chair of Nom & Gov is Winthrop Leverett III, who has served on the board since his founder dad stepped off as CEO and chairman 20 years ago, and Trian shows up and nominates a rock star female Hispanic public company COO, who may or may not have flown Apaches during Desert Storm, like then Tripp's in trouble, whether he is a good director or not, especially in a universal proxy environment. So yeah, it's a big red flag. But here's the rub. It's often hard to have these conversations when there's no activist knocking on the door, even if the company's underperforming. But yeah, do we spend a lot of time with our clients on clear days trying to proactively think about board refreshment, director qualifications, independence, performance, et cetera? Yeah, we do. Universal proxy is going to force boards to be more proactive and take a more proactive approach because, as we already discussed, the bar for an activist to pick off one or two incumbent seats is lower now.
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. And I often quibble with the term independent director, even though they may, by New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ listing standards, be considered independent. You know, activists often do their digging and find these relationships between the CEO and and directors that make them clearly not so independent and raises lots of issues. So, okay, one last topic. I'm going to throw this to Jillian, and then I don't know if we have Sebastian will have a minute or so to chime in if he wants. And, you know, we have to talk about M&A for the deal, and we're all about M&A. And activism with a deal-related focus is, you know, a big part of the overall activism sphere. So, Jillian, I wanted to get your thoughts. One, what kind of M&A activism are we seeing in today's market? I feel like there's three categories: sell the company, divest assets, lock an existing deal. Yeah, make an existing deal fall apart, basically. And two, do you recommend companies with, let's say, mini conglomerate type companies to conduct a periodic portfolio review? So if they do that, do you think that that would make them be better able to handle an activist's campaign targeting them?
Yeah. So your first question is just M&A activism. What are we seeing? I agree with you. There are a few key themes. You said three. I'll actually push you. I think there's four key themes. What we're seeing right now is that even though overall M&A volumes are depressed and the financing markets are still a little weak, M&A activism is about 50%, a little under 50% of all activism campaigns, which is a little bit more than it's been in the last couple of years. And it's split evenly between these themes of one, pushing for breakups, divestitures, pushing for a whole company sale, and agitating around existing deals. The fourth theme that I want to throw out there for you is that, you know, we've also seen a number of M&A related campaigns where activists actually come and push for board seats once a company has closed an M&A deal. And the activists and the rest of the shareholder base doesn't necessarily like the deal that already happened. So not traditional M&A activism, but activism related to M&A board seats.
Post-M&A activism proxy contest. That's interesting. Go on.
Exactly. But I will lump that under M&A activism because it's really all related. When we think a little bit more broadly about this, right? If you double click into the first two themes that you mentioned, this breakup, divestiture, and whole company sale theme, we tend to see the more traditional established activists utilize this theme within a campaign. So they're trying to identify ways that they can catalyze change, like I was saying earlier, and closing the valuation gap with their specific idea. And they're able to do that because they can say, spin off one of your divisions or sell yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, a classic example is multiple business units with one unit trading at a higher multiple and one trading at a lower multiple. The obvious thesis for an activist is to say, split those units up, then you'll get the higher multiple in the higher multiple business and a lower multiple in the other one, but you're not going to pull down everything to the lower multiple business. Mm-hmm. You know, we really only see the same from these traditional activists. We are also seeing right now a ton of activists agitating around existing deals. There have been so many announced in the past year, whether it's, you know, to sweeten the deal or to try to block the deal completely. But around this theme, we're actually seeing a lot of non-traditional activists becoming vocal. So really long-term shareholders of companies who don't have activism as their main fund thesis. But rather, they have a broad mandate and can just be vocal if they need to be. But it's really because they don't approve of a particular transaction of one of their portfolio companies.
Sebastian, do you want to weigh in on that? Do you think existing M&A deals are, I guess, a hot topic for activism right now?
I couldn't have said it better than Jillian. Clearly, I married up.
Okay.
And on that, we should stop talking.
All right. Well, yeah, we are basically out of time. So I think that we'll wrap it up. This has been the Activist Investor Today podcast with Ron Orl, and I've been talking to Jillian and Sebastian Alzheimer. May you never have to face off against each other in a Carl Icahn director contest. Although if you were to have to face off in one, I would love to see that happen and write about it. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Ron.
Great. Thanks, Ron.